On air, online, on digital, and on the ABC Listen app.
Lachlan Bennett with the Tasmanian Country Hour on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Today on the program, could pandemic policy make the shearing shortage worse?
If our shearers can't work, and we can't work, like, we're going to have to move, and the sheep will not get shorn because there's just not the amount of shearers there anymore.
And farmers demand a greater say in the dairy poll.
Because this isn't about how you want to vote for Dairy Australia's poll. This is for making sure you have the options that are available for you to vote.
We'll have those stories and more a little later in the program, where we'll also take a trip to the Weather Bureau and find out how farmers have been coping with the torrential rainfall in the northeast. G'day, it is Lachlan Bennett here in Burnie on this Friday. We'll get the latest on the livestock markets a little later in the show, but we're going to kick off with a topic that has been dominating the national discussion, climate change. As we start the program, thousands of students across Australia have walked out of the classroom to join the International School Strike for Climate. The protests come in the countdown to one of the biggest climate conferences of all time, set to be held in Glasgow at the end of the month. And it also comes amid paralytic debate within Australian politics about how to tackle emissions, what our targets should be, and ultimately, who is responsible for developing the world net zero target. Well, joining me right now in the studio is Somerset beef farmer Pippa Mills, Rocky Cape farmer Tasman Bourne, and Carly Franks from the Australian Parents for Climate Change. Welcome to the Country Hour.
Hi, Lachlan. Thanks for having us.
Now, I want to kick off with you, Pippa. Farmers are generally pretty busy people. So why did you want to take the time to leave the farm and be involved in the climate strike this afternoon?
This comes from a place that's, as farming is very dear to my heart, my children looked at reports from the US about feedlot beef, and I had to take the time out to explain to them that we can grow beef differently here in Tas, and that accounting for our carbon and the environment is a very important part of it. So it's important to the kids, and it's important that farmers have a place in achieving net zero, politically, environmentally, everything.
Well, some of our listeners might actually be a little surprised to hear a beef farmer wanting to get involved in a climate strike. Beef has been a sector that's been in the firing line of a lot of activists lately.
We do. We have some real methane issues that we have to tackle, and that doesn't go away just because we're beef farmers. There's an opportunity there to use grazing animals to restore the environment, and we see the potential there to do that the right way. So we're currently going through our numbers, getting our carbon accounted for, and it's really important that we know and measure what they are, because beef feeds a lot of people and Australia can't grow vegetables everywhere. So I see it's part of the solution.
And you're not just a slogan shouter. You've actually done a fair bit of work on your farm to help reduce the environmental impact.
We're always working on new ways to do that, and we're learning as we go, and certainly getting involved with groups along the way and finding new farmers extends our knowledge with how we rotationally graze, how we protect our waterways, how we get birds and wildlife back into those farming systems. It's really important.
Now, Tasman, I might jump to you. You're a beef farmer out in Rocky Cape. You homeschool your kids, so are they refusing to come out of their room today? Are they holding up placards in the kitchen?
No. Actually, I wasn't aware of the student strike until Pippa rang me yesterday to see if I'd join her on the radio. But no, they're not joining in today.
But this isn't the first time that you've had an interest in looking at how you can improve environmental practices on your farm.
That's right, yes. For the past 8 or so years, we've been working down the path of regenerative practices on our properties. Probably the primary ones is reducing our tillage to prevent erosion, and also diversifying our pastures, so we've got a wide range of species in our pastures, so it's both resilient and also a much more rounded meal for our cattle.
And has it been a tough process to do all those things?
It has, yes. It's not straightforward. In some respects, the normal way of farming, the conventional way of farming, is a lot easier because you've got lots of tools in your toolbox with different chemicals and fertilizers and so forth, where you can quickly fix a problem that arises. We've got to have a bit more of a long-term vision, trying to anticipate what's coming, and also have to have a bit more room in the system to buffer changes so that we don't run out of feed for our cattle.
And one of the things you've done is get rid of almost all artificial fertilizers.
Yes, that's right. On a couple of our properties in Rocky Cape, they haven't had any artificial fertilizers for about 4.5 years. And our property in Wynyard, we've only had that for a year and a half so far, and we have applied some there just to help start that journey towards building the soil.
Now, Carly Franks, I might jump to you. You're not a farmer, but you are part of Australian Parents for Climate Action. What role do you think agriculture has in this debate?
Well, Lachlan, like Pippa and I were just talking before we started, you know, it affects farmers first. So I think that that's the role that we need to appreciate when we're looking at climate change. And to be honest, like a lot of the people that are involved in the climate talks that I've had just in our community of the last sort of 12 to 18 months have been from the farming community. So that's really inspiring.
So it hasn't been hard to get them on side at all?
No, not at all. If anything, I'm coming in and learning from them like I am today about what they're already doing. So that's really inspiring, yeah.
Now, the federal government has yet to commit to a net zero emissions target, but in Tasmania this week we saw the Liberals commit to net zero by 2030. Now, that's something that we've actually already achieved in Tasmania a few years ago. So what do you make of that target?
Of the target in Tassie?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I think it's fantastic to have a target. I think we need to set an ambitious target. I think what we need to make sure is that we're, you know, ticking all the boxes in the best way that we can. So while we might have a target, it's also looking at, well, how can we make sure that we are going above and beyond that target to ensure that all of our industries are looking at how they can reduce emissions. You know, I really want to be able to say to our kids that we tried our hardest and that we continue to try for them.
Now, Pippa, what does it mean for you to have a Tasmanian target but not a national one?
I think I'm really proud of living in Tassie and having that, and having the forests and the carbon stores that we do to be able to attain that goal. I think we need to protect them, and I think if we can lead by example for the rest of the country, that would be great. But I think we could lead far more strongly, as Carly said, setting a 50% target. Let's go for 75%. Let's show them that we can, because it's just going to make a better place for our kids.
And you don't have any uncertainty about what sort of direction you need to move?
I think there's always new things. So there's lots of new technology coming along, particularly in cattle with algae and different species of grass. And so we're always learning. In terms of the fact that we need to, there's no uncertainty in my mind that we need to be moving towards that now. You know, the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The next best time is now. We need to be doing it now.
Now, Tasman, what would you like to see happen either politically or in industry to make your transition a little easier?
I think an important thing is dialogue. So it's great to have communities and organisations of people that can come together and talk about these things and work on outcomes together. If you're out there on your own, it's very difficult to try and figure out, you know, what you should do on your farm, how you can do things better. And, you know, when there's dialogue and conversation, it's very helpful. I'm a bit worried sometimes by the targets that are set sometimes, where they may be a bit unrealistic, and maybe not everyone involved has been consulted, particularly in like I'm speaking from an agriculture point of view. Mm-hmm. So that then there does need to be good conversation so that everyone can agree, yeah, we can achieve this instead of damaging things along the process.
Now, Carly Franks, what's your take-home message today?
My take-home message is to be brave enough to enter this space and to learn as much as I can and to be able to say to my kids, you know, so we can all say to our children later on that, you know, I did what I could and I became as informed as I could be.
Pippa?
I think, yeah, becoming as informed as you could be, but also joining in with groups. For me, joining groups like Soils First and the Australian Parents for Climate Action has helped me become informed, and it's helped me reconcile my beliefs and say, look, this is important. There are other people that feel it's important. I'm not going to sit at home and go, I don't know what to do, which I think you can do very easily, but joining those groups and finding other people. So this afternoon's rally is not about jumping up and down and causing a riot. It's about solidarity and finding other people and saying, look, we're in this together and we think there should be things done.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your insight. That is Somerset beef farmer Pippa Mills. And you also heard from Tasman Bourne, who has cattle up at Rocky Cape, and Carly Franks from Australian Parents for Climate Action. And they joined us just ahead of the school strike for climate happening in Burnie this afternoon. And I understand there's also some protests going on as we speak at the Hobart Regatta Ground. Well, climate change is an incredible challenge, but up next we'll see how farmers can adapt and perhaps make a little cash on the side.
This is Lachlan Bennett and the Tasmanian Country Hour on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Well, as concerns about climate change continue to dominate the national discussion, the Tasmanian Institute of Agriculture is learning how farmers can adapt. The Nexus project is developing an intricate model that uses real farm data to understand the impact of climate change and what adaptation strategies work. Associate Professor Matthew Harrison explains how it all came together.
So we get all their production statistics, put it into a model their biophysical livestock production, pasture production under current climate, as well as their profitability. We sense check it with the regional reference group and the farmer groups and the actual case study farmers so that it's a form of calibration. Once that's done, we move on to the simulating the impact of future climate change, and this is where modelling sort of comes into its own, because you can perturb current climates as they exist today, increase carbon dioxide content, increase the frequency of heat waves, droughts, and indeed extreme events in general, so rainfall, wind, all of that sort of thing. So all of that is thrown into the mix, and then we can simulate what's the impact of a future climate in 2030 or 2050 going to be on those case study farms if you don't adapt. And then the third step is we impose adaptations on top of the case study farms. And those adaptations fall into four broad themes. So some of them are a simple low-hanging fruit, like changing soil fertility and incorporating legumes. Other ones are income diversification. So what can you do to derive income from something that's not reliant on the rainfall, so climate invariant. And the final type is what's called transformational. Now, that's a term that's perhaps overused now, but transformational is the Big Mac, is combining everything of income diversification, low-hanging fruit, and what's called towards carbon neutral, into the whole system of a package of adaptations, if you like. So we can see what might happen to productivity, profitability and emissions. So that's why it's actually called the Nexus Project, because we can look at multiple metrics at the same time.
And when you've got that data and put it into those models, you can see what various options primary producers might have, how they might be able to deal with these changes.
The models that we use, both biophysical and economic models, and because we can simulate things like heifer and steer production and or prime lamb production and possibly fine wool production as well, we've got real numbers on that. We can get the economics on them. And then if we impose a future climate, for example, in the Midlands, the actual pasture production will go down in 2030 and 2050. And so what that does is we can reduce the stocking rate so that the actual ground cover and sustainability is similar to what it has been historically. So we can look at what the effects of whole farm systems changes are at the interaction between animal feed requirements, pasture supply, changes in climate, changes in soil carbon sequestration, and changes in net greenhouse gas emissions. And so the farmers, because the farmers are co-designing it with us in a sort of an integrated participatory way, they actually can sense check it and they can say, well, those numbers that you've got there on, I don't know, you know, pasture production or supplementary feed are not realistic. So we go back, adjust the model, have another crack at it, and then meet with them again and say, well, this is what we've adjusted based on your advice. So they get confidence in the results, and then we can go away and implement the adaptations that they suggest. So one thing that we've found, climate change to 2030 in the northwest will be probably beneficial, mainly because rainfall won't change much, but carbon dioxide content will go up, so that will benefit pasture production. In contrast, climate change in the Midlands of Tasmania is only likely to increase evapotranspiration. Rainfall will decline slightly, so even if rainfall was the same, your increasing evapotranspiration would dry the soil out quicker, so therefore your pasture production would still go down even if rainfall was the same. But because temperature is going up, evapotranspiration goes up, and therefore your drying power of the air, or what's called vapor pressure deficit, also increases. So simply to maintain pasture productivity, you'll need other interventions, and that's sort of what we're looking at.
Associate Professor from the Tasmanian Institute of Agriculture, Matthew Harrison, ending that report. Well, adapting to climate change doesn't have to be all pain and no gain. Carbon projects have the potential to improve productivity and the bottom line. Joining me now is Dr. Kerry McCosker, who is a pioneer of regenerative agriculture in Australia and a keen advocate for carbon farming. Welcome to the Country Hour.
Thank you.
Now, you're currently on King Island. You're actually just about to chat to farmers at the King Island Beef Producers Conference. Can you give us a bit of an elevator pitch for carbon farming?
Well, I'm going to be focusing on soil carbon, which I think has many, many benefits to it. And we're going to be looking at what's it take to be able to sequester carbon, what sort of soils do you need, what practice changes do you need, because it's not simply a matter of just signing up to a carbon project. Generally, we've got to be doing something different to be able to create that carbon. So we'll be working through a lot of those issues in a fairly short period.
And there's a lot of interest in this at the moment, a lot of big companies and brands trying to be carbon neutral. How can farmers take advantage of this wave of interest?
Well, at the moment, as evidenced by the increase in the price of ACCUs over the last few months, the demand for Australian carbon credits is now greatly outstripping supply. We've gone from $17 a tonne earlier this year to about $30 a tonne already. We weren't actually budgeting $30 a tonne till 2026, and we're already there. So as that carbon price goes up, it makes it much, much more attractive for farmers to get involved. And it's a win-win, I think, for everybody, soil carbon. Firstly, I think the focus for a farmer should be, what do you need to do to increase your productivity and improve your profitability? And carbon should be an outcome of that, not the primary motivation for doing it.
So people shouldn't be, you know, looking to chase a few extra bucks. It should be about a whole of a farm approach.
Absolutely. And the extra bucks will come if you're doing everything else right. But there is significant changes. It's not necessarily an easy thing to do. There's a lot of legislation, a lot of rules. So farmers need to be aware of that.
So what advice would you give for anyone wanting to try and get involved but don't know how?
I think it's look into it pretty carefully. There's a lot of people out there now, you know, that will aggregate carbon for you and say they're going to do a carbon project. One of my own companies, we've just spent 15 years on research and about $5 million on working out how to measure soil carbon accurately. And I don't think there's too many others that have spent that kind of effort to work out how to do it well. And so just be careful. And some of the data that we've got, for example, shows that, and one of the examples I've used today is, if you're comparing two aggregators, how do you actually compare them? And mostly farmers compare these things based on cost. But cost is really not the measure here. It's profitability that's the measure of doing a soil carbon project. And if you bring your cost down too low, you end up with very high variability in your soil analysis and therefore no carbon to trade at the end of the day. So something which looked like it was pretty cheap and cost-effective to begin with actually brings you no income down the track. And that'd be a disaster.
Yeah, well, plenty to think about there. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Terry McCosker, a consultant and pioneer of regenerative agriculture and also the founder of Resources Consulting Services.
Know a young person who's up to something great? The ABC is looking for trailblazers aged 18 to 28 who are doing inspiring things in their regional town.
Projects that strengthen the pride in my community.
To give young women, particularly rural women, their voice.
Trailblazers will have their work featured on the ABC and receive an amazing package of support. Apply now for the Trailblazer program at abc.net.au/trailblazers. Hurry, entries close November 10.
The Country Hour with Lachlan Bennett on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Dairy farmers, angry at a lack of voting options in the upcoming dairy poll, have launched a petition to demand change. Farmers can currently vote for one of three proposals to increase how much they have to pay in levies to Dairy Australia and one to keep the levy the same. Dairy farmer Bernie Free is concerned there's no option to reduce the levy and says the industry needs to provide a full suite of voting options.
Yeah, I've started a petition to ask for some more options to be on the poll for the dairy levy poll, so that we've got a reduction and a no levy ask on the poll, so that we have all options. Well, if you want a democratic process, we need to have a reduction.
Hey, Dan, can you hear me?
The levy poll. It's about a democratic process. It's not about
doing
as to whether we should or shouldn't have an increase or stay the same or a decrease. Yeah, we're asking for the options to be on the ballot paper.
Why is it important to you to have those options, not only...
Deal with you shortly, about 4 minutes.
...of keeping the levy the same and increasing it, but also adding a lower levy option and a zero option?
So that farmers that aren't happy with what Dairy Australia is doing have a choice. As leaders in the industry, we need to convince those farmers that aren't happy that they need to vote the way that the leaders think that they should. So without having that option, those farmers can't show what they really want.
Ron Storey, the head of the levy poll advisory committee, said if farmers were angry, they could vote to keep the levy the same and that would be a way to express those views. It sounds like you don't share that same view as Ron Storey.
No, because that's only half of the voting options. It's a bit like cutting out the Liberal Party out of the voting selection for a state or a federal election. You haven't got all options available for you. By having a stay the same, that's not showing that they're really disappointed with Dairy Australia.
The advisory committee as well and others in the dairy industry have said that farmers wanting a lower vote option are a vocal minority. There's not many of them, and it wasn't worth adding that to the list because it doesn't really show the views of wider dairy farmers. What do you say to that?
I say to that, saying the lower option is not going to get up, is what they're telling you by saying that it's a minority, and why not put it on there so that they can have their say?
Do you expect there will be a large amount of people to sign this petition?
I hope there is a large number of people to sign this petition, because this isn't about how you want to vote for Dairy Australia's poll. This is for making sure you have the options that are available for you to vote.
How many signatures do you think you need to show that this is something a large amount of the dairy industry wants?
That's a good question. It'd be nice to get a 500 signatures on there.
Is that what you're aiming for?
I haven't got a name. I want to have it out there for long enough for farmers to be able to vote on so that we can get the opinion of as many farmers as we can.
Dairy farmer Bernie Freed from Winslow in southwest Victoria, speaking there to Warwick Long. Still to come, how farmers in the northeast are coping with the torrential rain, and could vaccine mandates fuel the shearer shortage? Now it's time to catch up with Brooke Oakley from the Weather Bureau. Brooke, there's been plenty of rain today.
There sure has. We've had a rain band that's moved over the state. So in the start of the day, most of the rain was about the northeast, and that's now migrated so that most of the rain is about the south of the state. So the rainfall totals 2:09 a.m. this morning. The highest was Grey with 182 millimetres, followed by St Patrick's Head with 157 millimetres. And there were widespread totals in the northeast of greater than 50 millimetres. Since 9 a.m, the highest total has been 15 millimetres on Mount Wellington, followed by 14 millimetres at King Island, and most of the falls have been in western, southern and central areas since 9 a.m. And we are expecting that rain band to keep moving further south. It's currently sitting just over Hobart at the moment. But behind the rain band, there will be showers, which will continue throughout the day. And they'll be more frequent about the south and west. There's also isolated thunderstorms possible about western, southern and central areas, with possible hail and heavy falls, and fresh to strong and gusty southeast to southwesterly winds about the west and south, and northwest to northeasterly winds elsewhere. And the reason the winds are all over the place is because we do have a complex low pressure system moving over the north of the state, and the centre of that is currently just off the northwest coast.
And we had a few flood warnings earlier today. Where are they at?
There is a moderate flood warning current for the South Esk River, and at the moment the South Esk River at Fingal is above moderate, and also the St Paul's River at Lewis Hill is above moderate. There's also a minor flood warning for the North Esk and Macquarie Rivers, and a flood watch for the North and North East, Mersey, Huon, Derwent and South East River catchments. And all those river catchments are relatively wet at the moment, so they are primed to respond to all this rainfall.
And there's been a fair bit of rain today. Is things going to clear up in the days ahead?
It is generally an easing trend once we get through today and early tomorrow. So tomorrow there'll still be showers, but less frequent about the north. And those will ease during the afternoon and then contract to the west and far south in the evening as the low moves away to the east. There'll still be fresh to strong and gusty south to southwesterly winds. And then on Sunday, the showers will be confined to the west and far south, but mainly fine elsewhere with westerly winds. And then on Monday, the next cold front is due to move over the state. So we'll see showers about the west and Bass Strait Islands extending statewide during the morning and then contracting to the east and south in the evening. And the west to northwesterly winds will shift southerly during the afternoon and evening.
Now, what's going on in coastal waters?
On the coastal waters for today, southeast to southwesterly winds of 20 to 30 knots about the west and south, reaching up to 35 knots about the northwest in the evening, and northwest to northeasterly winds of 10 to 20 knots about the northeast. For the swells in the west and south, a west to southwesterly around 2 metres, increasing to 3 metres about the northwest late, and the wave rider buoy at Cape Sorrel is currently reading 2.1 metres. In the north, an east to northeasterly around 1 metre, and in the east, a northeasterly of 2 to 3 metres, and a southwesterly of 1 to 1.5 metres offshore in the south. And the wave rider buoy at Maria Island is currently reading 2.5 metres. Heading into tomorrow, south to southwesterly winds of 25 to 35 knots about the west and south, extending throughout during the morning. Those winds are decreasing to 20 to 30 knots about the north and west during the afternoon. The swells in the west and south are west to southwesterly around 3 metres, and also a northeast to southeasterly of 1 to 2 metres. In the north, a westerly of 1 to 2 metres offshore, and in the east, a northeast to southeasterly of 1 to 2 metres, and a south to southwesterly of 1 to 2 metres building to 2 to 3 metres. So with that in mind, there are a number of warnings in force. So in addition to the flood warnings, there is a gale warning current for northwestern coastal waters from Sandy Cape to Stanley, a strong winds warning for northern coastal waters from Stanley to the northern tip of Flinders Island, and also for southern and western coastal waters from southeast Cape to Sandy Cape, and a warning to sheep graziers for King Island today. That warning to sheep graziers extends to the southeast and east coast forecast districts tomorrow. And for tomorrow, there is a gale warning for northwestern coastal waters from Sandy Cape to Stanley, and for eastern and southeastern coastal waters from St Helens to Point to southeast Cape, including Storm Bay. A strong wind warning for all remaining coastal waters, including the southeast inshore waters, but excluding Bank Strait and Franklin Sound, and a strong wind warning for the Central Plateau Lakes.
Well, plenty of things for us to keep an eye on. Thank you so much for taking us through that, Brooke.
Thank you, Lachlan.
Lachlan Bennett on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Well, as you just heard, there has been some pretty wet weather so far. You might have seen a little bit of it out in the paddock or hear it banging down on your roof. But one place where the weather has been particularly severe is the northeast. As always, Grey led the way with a mighty 182 millimetres, but it was damp no matter where you looked. Luke Radford rang around the district to see how people were getting on.
Fred Woods, Kingville Pastoral at Malahide. I haven't really looked at the gauge. I've been up all night, to tell the truth, but 44 mil, I guess, here in Fingal, pushing up towards St Mary's, Grey and Paddy's Head, 200 mil. Yeah, a lot of water from that area. Mount Victoria, sitting at probably 60 mil. Just a nice little flood in that river, but yeah, they all meet down below home and causes a lot of water. Just, it's going to set us up, for the spring. It's the perfect time for us, except it was... Unfortunately, it was lambing, in the middle of lambing, so we might have lost a few lambs. You can't pitch the weather in some sort of way, but I think in the bigger picture going forward, it's going to set us up for a good spring and plenty of feed coming in the summer.
How's the landscape looking at the moment?
Down in front of my house, there's a lot of water, and I was up all night pushing a few sheep back further paddocks. I've got a good understanding of this river, and I had a few mobs that I thought they might have been safe just to push back at 1 o'clock this morning, sir.
Craig Lockwood from St Helens. We've seen continuous rain for the last couple of days and considerable flooding in the areas of the paddocks at Priory, as well as the causeway being closed on the Binnelong Bay Road. And I think that's the first time I've had a closure this year. So this recent rainfall has been a lot heavier than a lot more consistent than what previous rainfall events have been.
It's a heck of a lot of rain. You obviously operate at least 65 oysters. What's happened to your oyster farm?
Well, we've had ongoing closures right through this winter period. Coming in through now, we're into spring. It's continued. We did manage to get a quick harvest in yesterday, and that's about it. So we're open and closed more often than not these days.
So what's the impact of that meant for you going forward into summer?
Well, the actual stock levels are impacted because we can't continue with the flow that our system normally requires. And we also see a hold up in terms of growth because the ongoing fresh water continually kills off the algal growths that we get starting up, and that impact on food also relates to a loss of growth.
My name's Alison Napier, and Harefield St Mary's. From someone who has beef cattle, it's been awesome. We love these sort of conditions because we know that we're going to have good feed for, well into the spring and summer.
Have you finished calving yet?
Our heifers are finished, but we've got a couple of weeks of our cows to go, mature age cows.
Well, your area had roughly somewhere in the market, I think it was 180 millimetres of rain, which is a monumental amount. What does that mean for your animals that are in calf?
We take the rain events from the northeast pretty seriously, and we're very proactive in the way we manage them. So we were organised and were taking action sort of early in the week to make sure that all livestock were high and dry before it even started raining.
Glad to hear it. When's the last time you saw a rain event like this?
To be honest, about 2 weeks ago. it's a feature of where we live, and as I said, we love it.
If you were going to describe it to someone else, how wet was it this morning?
To be honest, I'm not exactly sure because it was too wet to even check the rain gauge. I had to leave early this morning, and I certainly made sure there was daylight before I left so I could see exactly how deep floodwaters were.
Alison Napier, a beef farmer at St Mary's, finishing that report from Luke Radford. And definitely plenty of rain around today. An incredible 182 millimetres at Grey. Still to come, we get the latest on the livestock markets with Richard Bailey and why pandemic policy has some shearers worried. We'll get to that story in just a moment.
This week on Landline, saving old oyster shells from landfill to recreate lost oyster reefs.
Oyster reefs are extremely important components of our coastal landscapes, and we know that in Moreton Bay we've lost about 96% of them.
And why fence with wire when you can do it virtually?
In this part of the world, there has never been a trial and experiment like the one that we're doing on the scale that we're doing.
That's Landline, 12:30 Sunday on ABC TV.
Lachlan Bennett with the Tasmanian Country Hour on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
The shearing shortage is on the minds of many Tasmanian farmers, but could COVID vaccination policy push workers from one state to another? In Victoria, some shearers are threatening to move interstate to escape the mandate that all authorised workers must have had their first dose of a vaccine. The mandate comes into force today, but Bellina in central Victoria, shearing contractors Nick and Karen Van Elk have decided not to get the jab and are not forcing their workers to either.
This mandate that's come across us, like if our shearers can't work and we can't work, like we're going to have to move and the sheep will not get shorn because there's just not the amount of shearers there anymore.
Where will you move?
Well, we'll probably go to New South Wales if we have to.
Because the mandate isn't there?
Because the mandate's not there. And, and the shearers can still work. They can't work in Victoria. They've got mortgages and kids to feed. Like, it's just, it's outrageous, really.
So will you be going?
Well, if it comes to that, yes.
Just to clarify, so is it the mandate that you're against or getting the vaccination?
Just the mandate. Like, anyone's entitled to get vaccinated or not vaccinated. We keep a record where everyone's been and where they're shearing. So we tell them not to close contact one another and we just do the best we can to keep COVID away.
How many workers are affected by this?
Well, all up, we probably employ 40 workers. The 40 of them are, there's some vaccinated and some unvaccinated. Yeah, the vaccinated ones, if they can't work, well, the sheep in Victoria won't get shorn.
So if the sheep don't get shorn and the workers can't work because they're not vaccinated, wouldn't it be easier for the entire team then just to get vaccinated?
Well, I think it's personal choice. If they don't want to get vaccinated, and I don't think it's our right to make someone get vaccinated, it's a bit hard when they're saying you've got to make your employees to get vaccinated. It's not the right thing. They're telling people what to do or what to put into their bodies. Like, it's wrong.
We're standing out the front of one of the shearing sheds where your staff are inside working. What kind of discussions have you had with the workers, Karen, about this decision?
Well, we've asked all of our employees what their choice has been, and we respect their choice on whether they want to be vaccinated or not. We have explained to them about the mandates that are being enforced on all employers. We don't want to have to force them to stand down. We need them, and we have good working relationship with our employees, and we just don't feel that this is something that's going to keep that going if we have to stand down good workers and people that literally cannot be replaced.
What have they said about this?
You know, some have said if they really have to, they'll get it, but And others have said, you know, they're happy to get the vaccine. Others have said they really don't want to get it. But again, we support their choice to make an informed decision. We're not against vaccinations, but we are pro-choice. We think everyone is entitled to make that decision for themselves. It's not for us to tell them what they should do as far as the vaccines are concerned.
Are you both vaccinated?
No. I don't want to get vaccinated. If I get COVID, I get COVID, but it's just, it's my choice. And, it's no one else's choice as far as I'm concerned.
So the mandate comes into effect on Friday the 15th. How many more jobs did you have organised?
Well, we have a schedule that we stick to, of course, every year. And now that we have our busy season, we're already started, we have farmers already lined up from now till the end of the year, in total about 78,000 sheep that need to be shorn.
Will this cost you money, Nick?
Yeah, it will cost us money. We've got things to pay for ourselves, and we really don't know what to do.
In August in New South Wales, there were some shearing contractors who did contract the virus, perhaps while working. Is that a concern for you?
Well, I can't say where have they been or where they've gone. Like all of our workers, they leave work, go home, probably just go to the supermarket, get their groceries, and then they're back at work the next day. So if those other shearers travelling around, they could have been anywhere doing anything. Like, who knows? Like, I don't know how they caught it, so I can't really answer it.
Nick and Karen Van Elk ending that report. And in a statement, the Victorian government says it's relying on all businesses to keep their workers, customers and community safe. And it will have compliance officers on the ground enforcing public health directions. And down in Tasmania, health and aged care workers face vaccine mandates, but not for farm workers. Interesting change of policy. Still to come, we'll get the latest on the livestock markets with Richard Bailey and the loss of a historic barn.
What is positive? Lots of birthday cards, a thriving veggie garden, a new book or show. Positive is more than just things, it's a state of mind. Throughout October, the ABC is sharing tips, strategies and stories on TV, radio and online to demonstrate how a small change can make a big difference. In partnership with Lifeline Australia and Kids Helpline, the ABC shines a light on your mental health. To find out more, visit abc.net.au.
This is Lachlan Bennett and the Tasmanian Country Hour on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
It stood for nearly 110 years, survived drought and floods, but on Wednesday morning, a historic barn at Seaview Farm in St Mary's burnt down. The barn was built in 1912 and was the centrepiece of Frank Giles and Julia Weston's property, and it contained all of their farming tools. Luke Radford spoke with Julia about the damage.
Well, I was getting ready to go to Launceston, and so was Frank, and he'd gone down on the tractor to change the cows around because he changes them every morning. And when he came back, he just came tearing into the house saying, screaming out, quick, quick, the barn's on fire, call the fire brigade. And I looked out the window and it was just well and truly alight. So, and we don't know how it started. The fire big honcho inspector came up and he did a report and he said, well, I can rule out arson because we were around from about 6:30 to 8:30. There's nobody around. And he said, and I certainly rule out you two sitting on light for the insurance claim because there's no way you'd lose everything because we just lost everything in that barn. And well, I haven't, but Frank has because of the farming, you know. He's lost all his tools and his welding equipment and his woodworking machinery and the new poly house cover and the shearing plant and everything's gone, everything.
So what have you been left with? Are you able to look after your animals?
Oh, yeah, because we don't have dairy and we've only got sheep and cattle and the new calves we have that we've been feeding, he had the milk and everything in the packing shed, so he didn't have to, it wasn't in the barn, so he could feed the calves still, although he didn't have his ride on and his trailer to cut the feeders over to the calves, so I don't know how he did that, I think he did it in the old ute, but It's certainly set him back because he's starting to get ready for the blueberry season. You know, he was saying the other day, I've got to order some punnets. and he's still watering and cutting grass, you see, and he was cutting grass with the rider, and now he can't. So it's been a real blow to him. It hasn't changed my method of working because I'm a gardener and I've got all my tools and ride on separate, so it doesn't matter to me. But to Frank, it's a huge loss. It's a huge loss. Huge, huge. He's been collecting tools for years, you know, and it's just impossible to even itemise what he's lost.
And this barn itself, it was quite significant, wasn't it?
This is the whole thing. I mean, the contents is bad enough, and we'll have to sort that out, and it's going to be a real drag. But the barn itself was a historic. It was built in 1912 by the then owners, and it was a real classic barn. It was a beautiful old barn, and everybody knew that red barn. You know, they sort of. It was a sort of a landmark heritage barn. It wasn't heritage listed, but it was a heritage barn. We've got the sandstone block where it's got carved in the builders of it and the date, so we're keeping that. But that's the real loss, you know, that huge hole in the middle of the garden. It's really big. It's really big.
Mm. But holding onto that stone and holding onto the heritage?
Yes. Yes, holding on to the stone. And if we rebuild another barn, we'll try and build one in similar style, you know, with a pitched gable roof and put the sandstone block next to it. It's dreadful, dreadful.
I'm so sorry to hear that. What will you do next?
What will we do next? Well, it's a lot. I mean, Frank only said this morning, do you think we're too old to start again? I said, no, of course we're not. We get a lot of support because the one thing about when something like this happens in the country, you realise who your friends are, and they came out in droves, you know, to help, and everybody's offered help and said, you know, we're here to help you, whatever you need. And that is a really nice feeling. That sort of, it compensates for the sadness of it all.
Such a tough thing to go through, but really reassuring to hear that the community is rallying to help a farmer in their time of need. And speaking there was the owner of Seaview Farm, Julia Weston, and she was recounting the damage to their historic barn. Well, before we head off, we better check in with Richard Bailey to get the latest on the livestock markets. G'day, Richard. How are you going?
Yeah, going well, Lachlan. Going well. Bit of moisture around the state.
Oh, I imagine it was a pretty rainy day down at Piranha yesterday.
Yeah, it was interesting. It had been forecast, and we started in the shed, going well there, and then when we got outside, it started to drizzle a little bit. But it was pretty good. It was a pretty good day. There were agent charted 1,300 store cattle, which is 550 less than 3 weeks ago. Still a pretty good lineup. Not as much weight at the top end, and very few cattle under sort of 220, 230 kilos. So obviously people are keeping those lighter cattle till later, or the season's been good enough that they've been able to get better weights on them. Most of the buyers were local, but there was a bit more interstate interest yesterday. Four buyers buying cattle for interstate interest, so that also put a bit of a floor in the market. Just as a general rule, I think that the market was either fully firm to up to in places $40 dearer. Just as a bit of an idea, the heavier weaned calves made $1,820 to $2,060 a head, or to average 560 cents a kilo, and medium weight $1,650 to $2,080 to average $620, and light $1,420 to $1,880 to average 680 cents a kilo. Best of the heifers, $1,680 to $1,900 to average 500 cents a kilo, that is. Medium weights $1,480 to $1,710 to average 555, and light $1,240 to $1,600 to average 580 cents a kilo. The highest prices were in the yearling steers. The best yearling steers made $2,020 to $2,440 a head, or 475 cents a kilo. And medium weights $1,920 to $2,040. The best of the heifers made $1,960 to $2,320. And medium weights $1,740 to $2,080 a head. So, very good day for anyone selling store cattle at the moment. Certainly a lot of positivity around the beef industry.
And how are things looking across the country?
Most of the cattle prices during the week in Victoria and New South Wales held up pretty pretty similar. Cows got a little bit dearer again. They've been sort of edging up and edging up. I noticed it, say, at Mortlake on Monday, most of the heavy beef cows made anywhere from 370 to 420 cents a kilo, which is, you know, fantastic money. And once again, as we've said for many weeks now, the feeders and restockers in the main prime markets are the main drivers, and that's what's driving the Eastern States Young Cattle Indicator right across the board. And it's right through, you know, right through. Warren Johnson was telling me yesterday he sold at Roma on well, I don't know, earlier in the week or late last week, I'm not sure when, but he said that, you know, everyone was saying that the cattle market right throughout Australia is, you know, very, very strong, and, you know, the news is all good. Lamb market came back a little bit during the week, a whole heap of reasons for that. There were more lambs, at almost double the number of lambs at Bendigo on Monday, but with a few buyers out still with these COVID restrictions in their abattoirs. And they said at Bendigo that neither Coles or Woolies bought, but I noticed at Wagga yesterday, certainly Woolworths were back in the market. So the market was sort of, Bendigo was anywhere sort of $5 to $10 cheaper. But just remember, this is coming off some very big highs. You've still got most of your lambs, you know, averaging between sort of $8.90 and $9.20 cents a kilo, which is, you know, for this time of the year, extraordinary money. And then at Ballarat, numbers were greater and market similar to Bendigo. And then yesterday at Wagga, there were 34,000 lambs, and that market was $5 to $10 cheaper on their sale from the previous Thursday. But their averages were all sort of around about 900 to 920 cents a kilo. And then you've got restockers and feeders buying lambs to go back to the paddock or back to the feedlot up to $220 which ahead, which is, you know, extraordinary. And we saw store lambs on Tuesday that made sort of $180 to $100, and I think we topped at $198. So there's some good money around for that. Mutton market not quite as positive, but still okay money. This market came back significantly during the week. Two or three major exporters weren't in the southern markets. News is that Cedar haven't been taken over, but there's a new buyer come in to buy a portion of Cedar Meats, and they were out of the market this week. They were doing stock takes and a few things like that. But the good news of that actual situation is that they're going to open up Mildura, which is what one of their plants has been closed for quite a while. So there's some good positive news there. But just generally on mutton, you know, sort of 550 to 600 cents a kilo covered most, apart from the very heavy sheep that were more like 500 cents a kilo, Lachlan. So, you know, and although it's not the 650 and 7 that we're at a couple of months ago, it's still, I would thought, pretty good money. Most producers would be pretty happy with that in the middle of October.
Well, thank you very much, Richard. That is our livestock reporter, Richard Bailey, giving us the latest on the national markets. Now, that wraps up the Country Hour for another day and another week, but I'll be back again broadcasting from the beautiful Northwest up here on Monday. If you can't wait until then, you can jump onto ABC Rural Online or check out the ABC Rural Facebook page. There's a pretty interesting photo up there at the moment of an old stock tank that has been transformed into a pool. Well, another interesting agricultural idea. There's also a really fascinating story about the cost of sea freight and whether or not putting more ships on might be able to bring costs down. Definitely an issue a lot of people who rely on freight have been thinking about for a while. Until then, I'm Lachlan Bennett. This is the Country Hour.